Really?
Okay. So, last week we dealt with the question of how what it takes to change rabbinic law and biblical law. This week we're turning to the gray zone in between biblical law and rabbinic law, the world of asmachta. To just remind ourselves where we are in the context of Shvi'it before we launch into the larger topic. So the overarching halacha that we've been dealing with has been the question of Tosefet Shvi'it, the mitzvah to add to the seventh year. What exactly that means we'll talk about later in the series, in the fifth week, I believe. The mitzvah to add to the Shemitah year, both in anticipation and prohibit certain agricultural activities already in the latter part of the sixth year, as well as certain limitations in terms of the harvest at the beginning of the eighth. As we've seen in the Bavli's tradition, so Rabbi Akiva derives this from a biblical source, which at least at first glance sounds like it's talking about Shabbat rather than Shemitah, talking about the weekly Sabbath rather than the sabbatical year, which is something we'll talk about next week, which is what exactly do we learn? What exactly does this reflect about Shemitah that it is so integrally connected to the Shabbat day? Leaving the details for next week, Rabbi Akiva believes that this is biblical. We derive from this verse that's talking about ostensibly Shabbat that you should desist from plowing and from harvesting, which Rabbi Akiva understands to mean that already around this time of year, a little bit before, a little bit after, depending, you have to stop preparing the land agriculturally for Shemitah. Rabbi Ishmael believes that it is not derived from a pasuk, Netzalachal Moshe Sinai, but it's an oral tradition from Sinai. Now, in the Yerushalmi, and we looked at it last week, so the Yerushalmi asked the question, which is, okay, at some point, without, in the Yerushalmi, as we mentioned, there is no distinction between Rabbi Ishmael and Rabbi Akiva, at least explicitly. The Yerushalmi asked the question, okay, there was clearly a time in history in which we ruled, the consensus ruling was that it was prohibited to be involved in agriculture as you were preparing for Shemitah. And now it's not. Now, in the time of the Yerushalmi, that is not the practice. And Gemara had asked the question, well, why is that? Right? Why is it that the practice is not that way? Don't we have a rule, and this was last week's class, that you can't undo, you can't overrule the position of an earlier court, either rabbinic, maybe even biblical, as we discussed, unless the court in question is greater in number, in wisdom, and the like. The Yerushalmi's answer, and this is what we'll focus on, so now I'll pull it up on the screen, the Yerushalmi's answer was as follows. The Yerushalmi said, Rabbi Acha b'shem Rabbi Yonatan. Now, this is just one of those things to know. If you ever learned the Yerushalmi, one of the things that makes it hard, harder than Bavli, I'm not saying Bavli is easy, but one of the things that makes Yerushalmi even harder than the Bavli is there are no keywords, including words like said, right, amar, right? So in the Bavli, this would be Rabbi Acha b'shem Rabbi Yonatan amar. Yochanan said in the name of Yonatan. Here you don't get an amar. It's more like a colon, right? It's just, right? Imagine like you're reading the script to a play, right? There is no he said. There's just sort of the names and then a statement. So that's what you get here in the Yerushalmi. So Ri'acha b'shem Rabbi Yonatan, b'sha she'asru lamikra samchu. When they forbade it, they were relying on a verse. Uvishah shehitiru lemikra samchu. And when they permitted it, they were relying on a verse. Bishah sheasru. When they forbade it, lemikra samchu. They were relying on a verse. namely the verse of Rabbi Kiva in the Bavli, Becharish uvekatsir tishpot, you shall rest, you shall desist from plowing and from reaping. Becharish shiktsiro asur ve'ezezeh, Charish shel er shvit shu nichnas lashvit. Right, the case that we're talking about here is plowing in anticipation of Shemitah in the sixth year. And reaping where the plowing would be forbidden, meaning since plowing in the seventh year is forbidden, so harvesting that produce in the eighth year would also be prohibited. So that was when they prohibited it. And when they permitted it, let me cross them, they relied on a different verse. Sheshet yamim ta'avod, 6 days you shall work. Again, a verse which, at first glance, talks about Shabbat, the Sabbath day, not the sabbatical year. Va'asita kom lachtecha, ma erev Shabbat breishit at mutar la'asot nelacha shetishka hachama. Just like on Friday, going into Shabbat, you can work until Shabbat. We'll get to that maybe, I think, the fifth week, what exactly that means, so that we know we don't work all the way up to Shabbat. But basically, almost all the way up to Shabbat, right? I'm sure many of you have had the experience of having to run into Shabbat without time, barely any time to shower, especially in winter Shabbatot. You come back from work, right? Shabbat starts at 4:30. You get into the house at 4:25, right? Jump into a 30-second shower and hopefully get to shul. Right? On Shabbat, you can do that. And therefore, the Gemara here says that when they removed these prohibitions, they compared it to Shabbat. And just like Shabbat, you can work until the sun sets. So you can work all the way until the Shemitah year begins. Af Erev Shabbatot Shanim, so to the Sabbaths of years, at mutar la'asot melacha at shetishke achama. So too, until the sun sets on Rosh Hashanah of Shemitah, you are allowed to do work. You're allowed to plow the field. So that is the Yerushalmi's statement, that when we prohibited working in anticipation of Shemitah, we relied on a pasuk, samchu, right, relied, were supported by, and when we permitted it, we relied on a different pasuk. Now the question here is, what does that mean? Because normally, samchu is just the verb form of what's known as an asmachta. And as we'll see, usually asmachta does not mean an actual exposition from the Torah. It does not mean an actual exegetical move from the Torah. It means something else. What it means, we'll see. But normally, it doesn't mean what it seems to mean here. So last week, we already saw that Reb Chaim Kanievsky said this doesn't mean what we normally think of as asmachta, just because the word samchu is the verb form of asmachta. That doesn't mean this is an asmachta, right? The way to read this, Yerushalmi, is very simple. This is talking on the level of biblical law, of deoraita, like Rabbi Akiva. And samchu here means literally just relied on, meaning the earlier court understood the Torah one way, which prohibited working in anticipation of Shemitah, and the later court found a different verse, understood the Torah differently, and they thought it was permitted, and that's all there is to it. There's nothing special going on here. The only move you need to make is to realize that the word samchu, relied, just means that, relied on. Right? It's not something special, it's just to rely on. It's biblical law, and like we saw from the Rambam last week, when you're talking about biblical law, a later court is allowed to change its mind. An earlier court can rule that the Torah says something is mutter, is permitted. A later court can say asur, that it's forbidden, vice versa. That's fine. And that's all that was going on here. What I want to do, though, in the 50 minutes that we have, though, is explore another fascinating possibility raised by Rabbi Yisachar Tamar in his commentary on the Yerushalmi, Alei Tamar. For anyone here who's ever been to Shivat Har Tzion, to the Gush, and gone to their massive, 80,000-90,000 volume library, if you've ever gone in and gone to the back, where the rarer books are, there are several shelves filled with very rare books, and there's a big sign over it called, that says Sifriyat Tamar, right, the Tamar Library. The Tamar Library is is the library of this scholar who will be exploring, Rabbi Yisachar Tamar, who when he died, he donated his library, his very extensive library of rare books to the yeshiva, and they kept it intact as a separate library and put it in the back of the Beit Midrash with a picture of Rabbi Tamar over the shelves. But in order to understand what he is going to say, we need to explore this category called Asmachta. So what is in Asmachta? So often in the Gemara, you will have a case that follows. The Gemara will say, we have a law, and this law is supported by a verse, by a pasuk. The Gemara will then say, well, doesn't that mean that this is really a biblical law? And sometimes the Gemara will answer, no, the law is dirabanan, the law is rabbinic, ukra asmachta ba'almai, and the verse is just in asmachta, just in asmachta. So what is this asmachta? So the majority view in the Rishonim is that asmachta is a memory aid. And it goes like this, meaning, really, there are many rabbinic laws which are not based on a verse at all. They're not based on a verse at all. They're purely rabbinic. They're a decree. They're a takana. They have no biblical basis whatsoever. However, people were familiar with the Torah, with Chumash. They reviewed the Chumash on a regular basis. They heard it in shul on a weekly basis. It was translated for them on a weekly basis in shul with the Mitargim, right? It used to be that there would be the simultaneous Aramaic translation of the Torah. People were familiar with the Torah, with Chumash. And therefore, in order to aid people's memory, to make it easier to remember the rabbinic laws, rather than simply having a laundry list of rabbinic laws, of details, they would find a verse that, homiletically speaking, hinted, sounded like the rabbinic law in question, not because in any way it was biblical. It's rabbinic. It's totally and completely rabbinic. But, you know, if you know the Torah and you remember that it's attached to this pasuk. So when you read that pasuk, you'll remember the law in question, not because it's biblical, but just it was attached to it. To give you like a modern-ish example, it's not a pasuk, but the Chatam Sofer, when he created essentially Haredi Judaism, right? He created ultra-Orthodox, whatever you want to call it, not a great term, but fine, right, he created as a movement, he created the reactionary movement to reform and to neo-Orthodoxy or modern Orthodoxy in Hungary. His rallying call was Chadash Asur Minat Torah, right? All things that are new are forbidden from the Torah. Now, that rule is a real rule. It just has nothing to do with what he said it had to do with, right? It's a Mishnah. And what it means is that new grain, right, grain that was grown or took root, rather, after the second day of Pesach, after Tetzayin Nisan, is forbidden to be eaten until the subsequent Tetzayin Nisan, when the Karban HaOmer was brought, or when there is no Karban HaOmer, so then it's forbidden until the 17th, or the 18th, or what's it, whatever, till the 17th, whatever. The Gemara gets into exactly when it's forbidden until. New grain that's grown after that magical day is called Chadash, and old grain that's grown before that date is called Yashan. And it is forbidden to have new grain. So the Chatam Sofer borrowed that line and said, Chadash, Asrim and Atara, new things, not new grain, but new things are forbidden from the Torah. Now, nobody thinks that that's what the Mishnah meant, but it's helpful, right? It is a way of reminding you. Or, right, we have all, it's a mnemonic, right? It's a mnemonic. People knew the Torah, so if you attach something to a pasuk, they'll remember it, right? we have all types of mnemonics, right? Right. I don't know if they still teach it this way, but at least when I was in elementary school, when they wanted to teach us the colors of the rainbow, they taught it to us with Roy G. Biv, right? I assume at least some places, I see Orly nodding, so I assume after I was in school, they were still teaching it with Roy G. Biv, right? So, you know, even now, you know, I don't think about rainbows too much, but I still know, oh, red, orange, yellow, etc., right? That is why, right, when someone says that Tchelet, right, the tchelet on your tzitzit is indigo. The only reason I have any idea what indigo is because it's apparently the eye in the rainbow, right, in the biv, right? So when people say that the tchelet on tzitzit looks like indigo, I know it because of Roy G. Biv, right? So many, many, many Rishonim thought that a smachta is just this. It's a mnemonic. And I won't read through all of them. But I gave you a bunch of examples here. So, for example, the Rambam says this in number 2. He says, "Kol inyan she'ein lo remez b'mikra," anything that has no hint in the pasuk, "v'lo asmachta," nor even in asmachta, "v'yashar l'lamda b'achad amidot," or can't be derived through one of the derivative, the laws of hermeneutics of the Torah, "be'ilu b'vadom rim halachal Moshe Mitzinai," if it is indeed biblical, it's called halachal Moshe Mitzinai. Okay. And he says, sometimes you'll take this, and he gives an example like the way we attach all measurements to the pasuk of Eretz Chita U'Se'ora. For those of you learning Daf Yomi, we did it just a few years, days ago, right? That there are certain things that are based on wheat, right? There are certain things that are based on barley, right? So we go through Shivat Aminim when we say, look, each of the Shivat Aminim has a shiur that is attached to it. So, as we know, in most mitzvah that have to do with eating, you eat an olive size, which is about the size of a watermelon, right? So, we eat a kezayit, a bone the size of a barley corn is impure. So that is etzem kisora, etc. So the Rambam says in those cases, mi'chum le pasuk ze ke'en siman kedei shiyishmirum ve'yizachrum. They attach it to the pasuk so that you will guard it and you will remember it. Ve'ein zemi en yana pasuk. And it has nothing to do with the pasuk, meaning it's just a mnemonic. It just helps you remember it. Ze'ein inyan amram kra asmachta be'alma. And that's why whenever the Gemara invokes an asmachta, it says merely an asmachta. It's just an asmachta. The Torah is a mnemonic. Tosfos says the same thing in number 3, right? Kroy asmachta be'alma lu'ukme girsa l'simana. It's to establish your what you learn as a memory aid. Ramban says this as well. Ne'emar al klal asmach v'nyanim she'em yedivei sofrim u'lishanom hashagur birimazim huzeh mikra. Right, this is often, it's so that it will be familiar, it'll be hinted at. Rav Yehuda Levi in the Kuzari says the same thing as well. Talking with the Sheva Mitzvah B'nei Noach, which is attached to a pasuk in Bereishit, v'samuchu ala pasuk hazeh derech siman. It's attached to the pasuk as a reminder. So there's a whole group of Rishonim who say that whenever the Gemara says asmachta, what it means is that the law in question is totally and completely rabbinic. We attach it to pasuk as a memory aid. Now, why is a memory aid? Why is that helpful? So, in the 14th century, Reb David HaKochavi, writing in Provence, in southern France, in his Sefer Habatim, as well as Marzius, writing in the 19th century, in his Mevola Talmud, in his introduction to Talmud study, excellent book, which was translated into English, I think by Rabbi J.J. Schachter, if I remember correctly, say, why is it that we need this? Meaning, why is it that we have so many mnemonics? Because if asmachta really means a mnemonic, a memory aid, why do we have so many Roy G. Bibs? And he says, they both say that which seems eminently reasonable, and that is because the Torah, the oral Torah, was supposed to be not written down. It was supposed to be oral. And when things are oral, it is hard to remember them. So any aid to memory that you have is good, right? So the one written book they had was the Chumash, or was the Tanakh. So if you attach rabbinic laws to the Tanakh, So you'll remember them when you're reading through the Chumash. But since you're not supposed to write down the rabbinic laws or any oral law, it's helpful to have memory aids that are attached to psukim. So that is possibility one of what an asmachta is. It's a memory aid. Considering the fact that rabbinic law was not supposed to be written down, we needed all the help that we could get. Elsewhere, the Rambam says that sometimes it's not just a memory device, it's also for aesthetic reasons. Right? Learning shouldn't just be intellectually edifying, it should be beautiful. It should be pleasant to learn. And therefore, if we take a very, very technical law and we dress it up with homiletics, then even dry, cut and dry technical law will suddenly be attached to flowery language of the pasuk. He gives an example, but I'll just skip to what he says. Afal himelitzat shir na'emod. It's like a song, a poem. It's very pleasant. His hir ba'al midat tova. Right, v'samach ze lepasuk al tzad hamashal hashir, and we attached it to the pasuk as a parable and a song, a poem. Right, so sometimes he says we do it for aesthetic reasons. Again, it's not biblical law, but it's just nice. We like the Torah. The Torah sounds beautiful. So if we attach rabbinic laws, look, the Chatam Sofer, going back to our example of Chadash Ezra Min HaTorah, was an excellent publicist for his new worldview. Right? And if things aren't catchy, then they don't catch on. That's just how things work, right? It's very hard to have a movement without a rallying call, right? But if you can come up with something that has a, right, we all know the chop of advertising is that, right? Is to make sure that people associate what you, right, something that's important to you with something else that they already know, right? They want you, right, to associate car insurance with a gecko. Right, you didn't even know what a gecko was, but they want you to associate car insurance with a gecko, a talking gecko, and it works, right? And the Torah, so the rabbis, if they want to sell you on rabbinic law, they attach it. They want what you think of the Chumash that you think of their laws as well. Okay, I see. Have a question here. Judaism, as we know it, is completely rabbinic. It is the rabbis, the notion of oral Torah, give the Torah and other biblical writing its strength, power, and importance. Our notion of punishment for sins is rabbinic, and according to the plain meaning of the text, etc., etc. Right, no, it's obviously true that, right, the rabbis are heavily involved in everything we do in Torah. Not just when they decree things, when they interpret the Torah, which obviously gives them, you know, power over biblical law itself. That's obviously true. But nevertheless, the rabbis, not everything that the rabbis instructed us to do was because they thought that was what God had directly said, right? Sometimes when the rabbis say to do something, it's because they think that's what God directly said. And we understand those cases as biblical law. And sometimes they told us to do things because they thought it was a good idea, and therefore we consider that to be rabbinic law. That doesn't change the fact that the rabbis are involved in both processes, but they are different. Okay. So the first school of thought that we have is that asmachta means a memory aid. It's flowery homiletics wrapped around law. But asmachta, when it comes down to it, if you boil it down, whenever the Gemara says something is an asmachta, it means it is rabbinic entirely. And its attachment to a pasuk is for rhetorical purposes, for mnemonic purposes, for beauty, for aesthetic reasons, but not because it is a different type of rabbinic law. That's view number one. View number two is quite radical, and that is the view of the Maharil. Now, the Maharil, writing in the 15th century, is one of the most important sources of Ashkenazi practice, and is heavily quoted by the Rama, Rav Moshe Isserles, in his recording of Ashkenazi halachic rulings in his comments on Shulchan Aruch. And then he says something shocking. He agrees with the first group who say that an asmachta is not biblical. However, the first group thought that rabbinic laws that are supported by asmachtot, everyone understood that they weren't really biblical. The rabbis knew it. The people knew it. Everybody knew it. They were attached to psukim for memory. They were attached to psukim for beauty. But no one was tricked. No one was fooled into thinking that it was actually biblical. However, Maril says, nope, that's not what an asmachta is at all. An asmachta, it is true, it's a case where the rabbis did not think that it was biblical because it wasn't biblical. But it was not a case where the average Jew on the street knew it was rabbinic. In fact, that was the entire point. The point of asmachta was to take something which is rabbinic and trick the average Jew into thinking that it's biblical to make sure that they take it seriously. I know that sounds shocking, and it is, but let's look at it inside in case you don't believe me. The Maharil says, I was shocked the first time I saw it too. Maharil says, Amar, kol heichadid mar midira bananhu kras machta be'alma. Whenever we say that something is rabbinic, but it is an asmachta, hachi perusho, this is what it means. Badaita kanta dirabananhu, it is rabbinic, it's a decree. Vehem yatsu vadku masulahem smach mikra. And they went out and searched and found a verse to hang it on. Visamchu divrehem alav kidei lahachzikam. And they attach it to a bazook to support it. Sheishu svurim dehumi d'oraita v'yachmi rubo. So that people would think, mistakenly, that it was biblical and be stringent with it. V'lo atu lizalzel l'hakel v'divrei chachamim. And not end up being light with it, not serious about the rabbinic law. Right? So the Maharil says, yes, it's rabbinic, but no, the point is that you don't know that. Right? The rabbis know it, but you don't. They want to trick you so that you will take them seriously. Now, this is very problematic. In fact, it's so problematic that it is essentially what the Rambam refers to as Bal Tosif, the biblical prohibition of adding to the Torah. I'll say this outside, but the Rambam in Source 8 has the following thesis. As was mentioned here in the questions before, right? Someone in the comments here said, can you give us an example or two of these tricky asmachtot and about the trick that is just like all those teaching drashas if pshat? Okay. I mean, yes, right? It is definitely odd, right? It's more than a pet peeve, you'll see for a moment in the Rambam. Can I give you an example? Yeah, I'll give you an example in a minute. Let me just articulate the theory. And then we'll take an example. So the Rambam says as follows. On the one hand, the Rambam believes that the Torah grants the rabbis power to institute new laws, takanot, decrees, and that power is granted to them from a pasuk. Lo tasrum min adavar sheyagidu lecha yamin u'smal. Do not stray from what the rabbis say left or right. On the other hand, the Torah prohibits adding to the Torah. So the Rambam says, I don't understand. On the one hand, you tell me that the rabbis are allowed to add decrees. On the other hand, you tell me that if you're not allowed to add to the Torah. So when can you add and when can you not add? So the Rambam says the following. If the rabbis add a rabbinic decree, and they don't pretend that it is biblical, they make it very clear that it's rabbinic, then that is within their purview. They have the right to institute rabbinic decrees if they make it clear that it is rabbinic. But if they add a biblical law and they don't tell you the truth, they make you think it's biblical, then they violate Bal Tosif, because what they're essentially trying to do is add to the Torah. So, in other words, what the Maharil thinks an asmachta is, which is the rabbis tricking you into thinking rabbinic law is biblical, the Rambam probably thinks is a biblical prohibition of adding to the Torah, right? And the Rambam says, right, I'll just read a line or two. He says, "Hol v'yesh leveitin ligzor v'la'asor davar mutar v'yamod yisro ledoro." Since the rabbis have the power to forbid things, v'cheyesh lehen lahatir yisro Torah levisha'ah, and they can even permit biblical law, right? They can override biblical law temporarily. Mahu zesh yisirat Torah lo tosif alav v'lo tigra mimenu. Then what does it mean? Don't add and don't subtract. So he says, if yavo beidin v'yadir basar chayav v'chalav rezeh gorev, im yasur basar of v'yomar shu b'chlal agdi, v'umisar min ha-Torah, if they add to biblical law and they call it biblical, then they are violating. Aval im amar basar of mutar min ha-Torah v'eino na'asar oto, but if they say it is biblically permitted, but we rabbinically are forbidding it, they tell everybody it's only rabbinic, etc. So then it's permitted, right? So here we have thesis two. The Maharil says asmachtas when the rabbis are trying to trick people into thinking rabbinic law is biblical law. The Rambam seems to think that tricking people is the violation of Baal Tosif. The only thing that makes rabbinic law legitimate is that they don't pretend that their rabbinic decrees are the Torah. Okay, we have a few comments here. One second. So someone said, yes, to support someone messaged me that some people nowadays say, oh, that's just Midei Rabbanan, that's only rabbinic. Yeah, that's exactly what the rabbis were afraid of. Someone else, Ilana, says that this would be very problematic if someone had a little bit of knowledge about the workings of, Doraita and Darabanim didn't know which were which. Yes, right? A little knowledge here would be very, problematic. Trick you. Like the phrase, Moshe Rabbeinu for the rabbis to try and say that both their authority may be back to the Moshe, a chumrah should be clearly labeled as such. Yes. So, right, meaning, this may be, there is discussion as to whether, right, the same insistence on transparency, right, calling something a chumrah, calling something policy, rather than pretending that something is law when it's not, this discussion does get invoked in that context, right, in modern context as well. The final content, the few comments I don't understand, so maybe clarifications here. Presentation seems to be veering for the extreme right-wing danger close to Solomon Shachar Khan with Knesset Yisrael. I'm not sure I understand the question. People who have questions I didn't answer can clarify. That would be great. I will note parenthetically that the Rambam's opposition to trickery does seem to appear in earlier sources, in Avot Rabbi Natan, in a fascinating piece. And this was a piece that Rav Henkin made quite a lot of use of in his book, Equality Lost. In Avot Rabbi Natan claims, essentially, that most of us think that original sin, quote-unquote, was the eating of the forbidden fruit. However, the rabbis in Avot Rabbi Natan argue that that's not actually the first sin. First sin was slightly before that. The first sin was before that. What was the first sin? The first sin was that God told Adam, don't eat of the Eitz HaDaat, right, of the tree of knowledge. Adam told Chava, don't touch the tree, which is not what God said, right? He set up a decree, but didn't tell her that it was a rabbinic decree. And that was the first sin, because that was what enabled the snake to trick Chava. So the original sin was, as one of my teachers once put it, according to the Midrash, this is already, right, very early, Chazal, right, late Chazal, early Gonik, that the original sin was a man not trusting a woman with halachic knowledge. That was the original sin, according to Chazal, which is quite a striking statement, but that's actually what it says here, which is, Ezu siag sha'asa adam harishon l'dvarav. What was the rabbinic law that Adam set up? Harehi omer v'yitzav Hashem lokim al adam le'mor mikol eitz hagan achol tochel. U'me'itz adat ovara lo tochel minu kivim hachacham minu motamut. God said, don't eat from the tree. Lo ratza adam harishon lomar l'chava k'derech shamar l'akadosh baruch hu. God didn't want to tell Chava that. He told Chava, don't touch it, and if you touch it, you'll die. Aha! Ube'ota sha'a, once he put that in motion, the snake got an idea. And what did he say? He went over to Chava, and he said, he talked to her, Amarla, oh, you think you can't touch it, and if you touch it, you'll die. That's what God said. I'll touch it, nothing will happen. So if you touch it, you won't die either. So what did the snake do? He touched it, and other midrashic things, he shoved Chava onto it, and when she touched it and saw she didn't die, she said, oh, God must not have really said, don't eat from it, right? Because Adam had conflated his rabbinic decree, as it were, with the biblical law, so that led to Chava thinking that the snake was right, because she touched it and nothing happened, he touched it and nothing happened, which led her to believe that eating it wouldn't do anything either. So that's model two. Okay, I'll look at these questions, then I'll go to three. Chumrah can be dangerous. Yes, it definitely can. Especially when people don't know what is chumrah. Okay, I see that this question here keep going on the exact history of it. Unfortunately, we can't get through all the history of what it means that things were given to Moshe and how they were transmitted and how they weren't. Obviously, this is a big part of it. Unfortunately, we don't have the time today. Though, whoever it is who is an iPad and is asking about that, if you email me afterwards, I'm happy to send sources and shiurim that I've given in the past on that. It is a very important question. Someone else said authority lies with or within the people who they choose to follow. That also may be true. You can email me afterwards. I'll send you sources on that point. I have plenty of material on that. Okay. Third model in our final leg here, and that is the Ritva. The Ritva rejects all of this. Oh, sorry. Someone said they wanted an example of an asmachta. Sure. Let's say for the Ramban, right? For the Ramban will disagree with this. Maybe it's not a great example, but the Torah, in addition to the sexual prohibition, says "Bal tikrivu lo tikrivu legalot erva." You can't come close to violating it. Now, at one level, that might just mean, right? Likrav can mean intimate. So don't be intimate, meaning don't violate the sexual prohibitions. However, the rabbis expand that and say "lo tikrivu" means that things that are romantic are also prohibited with people for whom it's prohibited to marry. So hugging and kissing and the like would also be prohibited. The Rambam thinks that's biblical. The Rambam says, no, that's rabbinic. And lo tikrivu is just an asmachta. The rabbis are just attaching it to the pasuk. It sounds like it's from the Torah, but it's not, right? It's not from the Torah. Or kiddush, right? Kiddush al hayayin, right? They say, right, kadsheyu al hayayin. Now, that's not. Saying kiddush, having some sort of sanctification of the day might be biblical, but on wine, it's clearly not, and yet we sometimes attach that to a pasuk. Okay, so, but let's go to the third model. The third model is very, very different, right? So, as different as the first two models were, they both agree that asmachta is fundamentally rabbinic law. The first model said it's rabbinic and everyone understands it's rabbinic. It's just there for a memory device or for aesthetic purposes. The second position said it's rabbinic. but only the rabbis are supposed to know that. Everyone else is supposed to think it's biblical. The third model is the Ritva. And the Ritva says no. And he's playing on, and here's an example, another example, is the saying of Psukim, when you blow the shofar, relating to Malchiot, Zichronot, and Shofarot. Right? As scary as it is, Rosh Hashanah is around the corner. That's a bit terrifying. Right, you'll probably be getting the mail already about saving your seats, if shuls will be fully open by then. I have no idea. But if shuls in Toronto will be fully open, then seats for the high holidays will, right, will soon be, it'll be time to book. So, as we know, when we're in shul, we in addition to the blowing of the shofar, we say psukim that are related to Malchiot, to the reign of God, the monarchy of God, to Zichronot, to God's commemorating or acknowledging, knowing, reckoning with what we do, and shofarot about the shofar and all of its manifestations. And this gets attached to a psukim, to psukim. When the Gemara says this, the Gemara says, Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God said, Imru lefanai malchiyot zichronot v'shofarot. God said, say these psukim about God's kingship and memory and shofar. Now, what's the problem? The problem is that this is rabbinic, right? Saying the Amidah is rabbinic, and therefore saying the psukim within the Amidah is rabbinic. So how can the Gemara say, God said, say these psukim? God didn't say it. The rabbi said it. So the Ritva says, Mishum, the Alpha Gav de Psuke Malchiot Zichronot Vishofarot Einan Minatora El Midibara Midirabanan Titiparishna. Even though this is rabbinic, not biblical, Mikol Makom, Mimasha Amra Torah Zichron Trua. The pasuk from which we derive it is Zichron Trua. That in one place the shofar is referred to with this phrase Zichron Trua, a memory or a commemoration or a mentioning of blowing the shofar. You learn from here that it's the right thing to mention these verses. And Malchiot, we learn from an extra phrase of Ani Hashem Elokeichem, I am God. Skipping down. And that's why it's in a, God said it. Now he says, okay, but it's still rabbinic. He says, no. Shekol ma sheyesh lo asmachla min ha-pasuk. And asmachla goes like this. Heir ha-kadosh baruch hu shera'ui la-tokein, ela shelo kav'u chova u-masru la-chachamim. The Ritva says something very radical. He says, and asmachla is very strange. And it goes like this. There's biblical law, which God said, do it. Sometimes the rabbi have to interpret it, but it's biblical. God said it directly. Then there's rabbinic law. Straight rabbinic law, where the rabbis say, we as rabbis want to decree something, and we think you should do it. Then there's a middle category, and that's called asmachta, and that is where God programmed in an optional rabbinic law that he liked but didn't mandate. Okay? Shekol ma sheyesh lo asmachta min ha-pasuk, heir HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God made a note. Shera'ui la'asot kein. God is giving you advice. This is the right thing to do. Ela shelo kavu chova. But he didn't say you had to. U'masru l'chachamim, and let the rabbis do it. V'zeh davar barur v'emet. This is true and clear. V'lo k'divrei ha'mafarshim asmach v'shu k'derech siman shenu chachamim v'lo shekavanat ha'torah l'kach. It's not just a hint. It's not a mnemonic device. Chas v'shalom, God forbid, Yishtaka ha-davar velo yomar, it should be sunken. Shezu dat ninuhu, for it is heresy. Aval ha-Torah hi-ira mikach, u-masrach yuva davar le-kavo le-chachamim. God meant it, just didn't obligate it, right? So it's like where your boss, right, or your parent says, listen, this is a really good idea. I'm not telling you have to do it, If you don't do it, I can't say you're doing the wrong. I'm just telling you this is the right thing to do. I'm just telling you. It's my personal opinion, my strong personal opinion. You don't have to do it. It's not a rule, but my personal, very strong opinion. That is what the Ritva thinks Asmachta is. It's God, it's rabbinic, because the rabbis don't have to make it law, but it's rabbinic law where they're picking up on the hint that God left for them. He says, and that's why the rabbis always try to find a hint to what they're saying. All rabbinic law is somehow hinted in the Torah of Achas, Shalom Shichaseira Klum. So this is the Ritva's very fascinating idea. Asmachta is not biblical and it's not rabbinic. It's rabbinic law where the rabbis are picking up on a not-so-subtle hint by God. So it is rabbinic, but it's a rabbinic law that God wanted the rabbis, but he didn't force them to make into law. This is the position of the Ritva. And the Maharal is very, very, a very big fan of this. And he develops it at length in 11, but I don't think we're going to have time for it. At some level, this is related to the Rambam's position of Divrei Sofrim, which is anything, which is like a rabbinic law or biblical law where it's not clear in the Torah, but I'll leave that for the moment. Now, I'm gonna just throw out some implications of this. The Prima Gadim has a fascinating claim. He says as follows. Normally the rule is that biblical law, Safeg d'oraita, when there's a doubt about biblical law, l'chumra. You go to the stringent side. Safeg d'rabanan, when there's a doubt about rabbinic law, l'kula. You follow the lenient, right? You have the right to be lenient. The Prima Gadim, however, argues that asmachta, safeg asmachta l'chumra. That if there's a doubt in a case where there's an asmachta, then you have to be strict. So why is that? So Rabbi Yosef Engel has two possibilities. He says one possibility, which he thinks is crazy, which he raises and then rejects vehemently, is that this is like the Maharil. And he says as follows. If the Maharil is right, that the point of Asmachta is to trick you into taking rabbinic law seriously, then obviously, Safek Asmachta L'chumra. If you don't know whether, right, if there's a doubt about an Asmachta, since the rabbis want you to think it's biblical, you have to treat it as biblical law, and therefore be strict. He then says that's crazy. He says, no, 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 that can't be. He says, but what it is true, as he says, is the Ritva. Is if you think Asmachta is not biblical, but it's not rabbinic either. But it is rabbinic law where God strongly advised that you do this. He just didn't mandate it, and the rabbis chose to pick up on God's hint. So then he says, well, it's not quite biblical, but it's not biblical. Right? It is what God wanted you to do, and therefore it's like sort of biblical. And therefore, safek asmachta lichumra. I see I have questions, but I'm going to try to get the last point, and then I'll take questions. Why did I get into this, all this? How do I get to this? So, let's go back to where we started, and here we'll see Rabbi Tamar's amazing theory. So, if we remember, the Gemara said, the Yerushalmi said, at one point in history, the rabbis interpreted the Torah, they found a pasuk, samchu, that said you should not work the land in anticipation of Shemitah. Later in history, they permitted working in anticipation of Shemitah because they found a different pasuk, samchu. So what does that mean? So Rabbi Tamar says as follows. Listen, it's true. Normally, he's saying this isn't biblical, it's rabbinic. It's rabbinic. When they forbade working before Shemitah, that was a rabbinic decree. And when they permitted it, it was a lifting of a rabbinic decree. But now there's a problem, because as we talked about last week, when you want to undo legislation, rabbinic legislation, you can't do that unless you have a greater court. So how could the later court, how could the later court, which was not a bigger size and not wiser, permit working in the lead up to Shemitah? Aren't you not allowed to do that? So Rabbi Tamar comes in and says, I have an exception for you. And here's what happened. The Ritva said that Asmachta is a case where God planted a strong hint in the Torah. He didn't obligate you. And he gave the rabbis the option to take his hint and legislate it as law or not. If you want to, fine. You don't want to, fine. So then he says, but by Shemitah, God did something very surprising. And that is, he put two contradictory strong hints in the Torah. Two opposite hints. He hinted very strongly in one pasuk, v'charisha v'katzir tishvot, that you shouldn't work leading up to Shemitah. And in another pasuk, he strongly hinted that you are allowed to work in the lead up to Shemitah. So Rabbi Tamar says, in that case and that case only, rabbis are allowed to overrule the legislation of a previous court, even if they're not greater in number or in size. Why? Because since God planted contradictory hints in the Torah, that shows that God wanted the rabbis of one generation to channel his prohibitive hint, and the rabbis of another generation to channel his permissive hint. Meaning God himself thought that there would be different times which called for different measures. And in that case, because God planted both possibilities in the Torah, he gave any subsequent court the right to either forbid or to permit and choose which of the options that God planted in the Torah they wanted to take advantage of. So here he quotes the Ritva, and he says as follows, Umeata hashnei ktuvim ha'ilu einam machichim zeh, ela adraba mashlimin zeh. It's not really a contradiction. They complement each other. Shenimtzara davar l'chachamim she'asu kamo she'irtzu. God gave them the right to do what they want. When they see that the generation requires the more prohibitive position, God hinted that they have that right. He programmed it in as a possibility. And when they want to, they can permit it. And that's why they don't need stronger Beit Din. So really, Tamar comes up with this amazing idea. So just to recap, right? We have the Rambam's view. The Ramban, Tosfot, Asmachta is just a rabbinic law that's wrapped up around a pasuk for mnemonic or aesthetic reasons. We have the Maharil, who says Asmachta is when the rabbis want to trick you into thinking that rabbinic law is biblical. The Ritva says no. Asmachta is that gray area where it's rabbinic, but it's not a plain rabbinic law. It's a case where God has obligatory law and strong suggestions. And when he gives you a strong suggestion, you have the right to take the hint and turn it into rabbinic law at God's advice, and the right to ignore God's advice at your own peril. And then, right, Tamar comes and says, but sometimes God was one step farther. And God says, listen, I don't want to mandate this in either direction. What I want to do is I want to give you two options. I want to teach you that sometimes the right thing for you to do is to prohibit planting in anticipation of Shemitah. And sometimes it's not. But because God programmed in both options, the rabbis have the right to overrule the previous court, because they're not really overruling the previous court. They're just noticing that God programmed in two different sets of advice for different generations, and they're channeling God's will. And in this particular case, right, Tamar argues, God actually said, my will is different depending on the time and place. So what you get here based on the Ritva and, right, Tamar's expansion is this fascinating, what I call the gray area between rabbinic and biblical law. Right, it's not biblical law, which doesn't easily change, and it's not rabbinic law, which is purely rabbinic. It's cases in which God chose, for whatever reason, to not mandate, but to offer different options. And then, even when the rabbis take God up on his options, they are channeling God. They're not following his direct order, but they are channeling his will. And amazingly, according to Rabbi Tamar, in this case, God himself knew that different generations would require different rules. Some where the right thing to do would be to extend Shemitah to before Shemitah. In some where that wouldn't be the right thing. So in this case, God didn't leave one strong hint, but he left two strong hints, giving the rabbis the option to channel different optional godly commands or godly wishes depending on what the generation needed, which is an incredible, what I call the gray area, right? This is really the gray area, right? Do you call this rabbinic? Do you call it biblical? I don't know, right? It's optional fulfillment of divine will that God himself wanted to remain optional, right? And sometimes even optional in contradictory ways. So that is quite a radical thesis by Rabbi Tamar. That's what he thinks happened here in Shemitah. Next week, we will deal with, we will move away from the direct Yerushalmi, and we will focus on the messy connections between Shabbat and Shemitah, which has been implicit in everything we've been doing, and analyze what we learn from that connection between Shabbat and Shemitah. Like I said, the fifth week, we will talk about Tosefet Shvi'it, what exactly it means to extend Shemitah, and what that tells us about this time period and the weeks leading up to Shemitah. That will be week five. I have 2 minutes, so I'll take all the questions that are in the chat now. Okay, wait, I'm going to take off the share screen. This will make it easier for me. Okay, good. Is the Ritva's view a more radical approach to the Ramban view of Shvut of Shabbat with Ritva? Okay. For people who don't understand that, the Ramban has this idea in limited circumstances, right? The Ramban has similar ideas. By Shabbat, the Ramban says that in addition to the milachot, right, the formal prohibitions, God wanted you to create a spirit of Shabbat, which he biblically calls Shabbaton. In that case, he thinks that even the rabbinic laws are essentially an expression of biblical law. I don't know if the Ritva is more radical, right? The Ritva very much does like the Ramban. The Ramban, for the Ramban, that's limited to Shabbat, and it's not totally clear what the connection is between biblical and rabbinic law in that case. The Ritva himself seems to think that the difference is whether you violate the law once or all the time, right? If you violate the rabbinic laws on Shabbat once, then it's only rabbinic. If you do it all the time, then you've violated the spirit of the day completely, which is biblical. That's the Ritva's suggestion. That case might be a little bit stronger even than this Ritva, but it is localized to that halacha. Someone asked, could you find this type of competing asmachta for the Aguna problem? I don't know. That's a little bit, right, it depends what you mean by the Aguna problem. There are different Aguna problems. I don't think there are any asmachtot involved there. There's biblical law and rabbinic law that are involved there, but not per se asmachtot. Whether you can find one, I have no idea. I don't know of one. It's definitely not an area that the primary laws are derived from asmachta. So I don't know offhand. Are there other examples of the contradictory asmachta? I don't know. Ilana asked if there are other examples. I honestly don't know. This is the only one I know of. It's a fascinating example. I would have to comb through all of Rabbi Sachar Tamar to see if there are others. And he wrote this encyclopedic work on the Yerushalmi, so I don't know. If anyone finds another contradictory one, then please do let me know, because it is fascinating. Okay, and a few people said they liked this year, so I appreciate all of that. As usual, I loved learning with everyone. I know this one is a bit complicated, but I think it is fascinating about this gray zone between biblical and rabbinic law. As I said, next week we'll deal with the question of how connected is Shabbat and Shemitah, and in 2 weeks we'll close it off with asking what exactly does Tosefet Shviit mean, what does it mean to extend Shemitah, what does that tell us about Shemitah and these weeks as we lead up to Shemitah, so we have a little bit of insight on how to experience it. Okay, with that, a Shabbat Shalom to